Hawaii's Kilauea volcano could be about to get a lot more violent. The summit sat quiet behind a cloud of ash and rain on Wednesday. But geologists report that it started hurling chunks of rock the size of microwaves, like this one found in a nearby parking lot. The U.S. Geological Survey says that these so-called ballistic blocks could signal the start of bigger explosive eruptions as steam builds up beneath the surface.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's tenure has been marked by deadly anti-government riots and an exodus of citizens fleeing a severe economic crisis with shortages of everything from food to toilet paper. Despite all that, Maduro is still expected to win re-election on Sunday.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Friday, and it is the last business day of the week. We're glad you're along here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell at 510. Our regular Friday guest, Paul Nolte, is on vacation today, but we have another good guest for you in his place. We will be talking with a senior economics reporter at CNN Money to talk about some of the H2Q, Amazon H2Q hopefuls. A little bit later in the broadcast this morning, we're going to take a conversation with Brian Summers, who's the airline business reporter at Skift. Brian will fill us in on the latest information regarding the Southwest inspections, and also some other airline and aviation travel news. We will get to him in our second segment this morning. But first, let's begin with some of the markets this morning. And on the Dow, Dow futures are pointing toward opening gains on Wall Street, up about 76 points at 24703. Is the implied open, and the S&P futures are up about 5 points. NASDAQ futures this morning are up about 15 points. We're working through some computer issues, and we'll try to get some of the more global stocks for you a little bit later in the broadcast this morning. Let's begin with Lydia DePillis, senior economics reporter at CNN Money this morning. Amazon H2Q hopefuls will have finished their final conversations with the company, according to Chicago Inno. Those conversations have ended after interviews with each of the finalist cities. Chicago, of course, one of those. The HQ2 will bring with it 50,000 jobs, a $5 billion investment. But let's talk a little bit about what happens when those tax breaks, tax incentives are issued. Lydia is with us. Good morning, Lydia.
Good morning.
You've written about this, and I guess we're kind of concerned about, number one, what we have to give to Amazon to attract them, and what some of the side effects of that could be. What are the dangers here?
Well, so anytime you bring 50,000 jobs to a single city, no matter how big that city is, honestly, you're going to have an impact on primarily housing prices, but also other types of infrastructure like transportation. And this would happen over time, so presumably cities would have a while to adjust, but all you have to do is look at Seattle and what has happened there to some of their housing prices. Lots of folks being pushed out, especially difficult impact on renters. It's been great for homeowners who have seen their home prices appreciate a lot. So that's what people are primarily worried about. And the other secondary thing is the idea that Amazon is now going to be whatever city this is, their largest employer. And that has an impact on the political culture of any city. And the problem that folks have seen in the past week especially comes from Seattle, again, where the city council proposed a tax on large employers that would primarily have hit Amazon. Amazon objected, threatened to stop work on two big office projects that they had underway and put those 7,000 or so jobs in some other city. And the council did go ahead and pass that, a modified version of that tax. But the lesson was, look, Amazon is now going to be able to push you around. And do you want that kind of presence in your city. So that's what folks are worried about.
Yeah, and this the bill that the city council in Seattle put forward was one that I think a lot of people would agree on. It was to help combat homelessness there. It was a 26 cents tax, I believe, for each working hour. Companies with more than $20 million in annual revenue, the money going to homeless activities. It almost felt like, as I was watching this, sort of like a hostage situation almost with Amazon.
Well, there's no way to put it. Certainly, Amazon has invested a lot in Seattle. They have enormous footprint in the South Lake Union neighborhood. And so it's not like they could just pick up and move. And I think the city council correctly read that companies starting to make money these days. I mean, they've always made a lot of money, but they've always poured so much back in that it doesn't show up in profit, and that's changed. Right? The last quarterly earnings report had them making, you know, billions of dollars in profit, and that will presumably continue. So basically, the city council's gamble was, like, Amazon can see me. Are they really going to leave? And I think the answer was no, they were not going to leave, but they were pissed off, and they made that known.
And part of this, too, I mean, it's a two-way street here, because the folks at Amazon would say, hey, listen, Seattle City Council, you could probably spend money, have a better spending plan here, that there's been a lot of wasteful spending. So in a way, Amazon sort of poked its head into that leadership role as well.
There were a lot of concerns that are you spending money that you have well enough? And, you know, I think that that could be true, that there are inefficiencies and there are policy changes that could be made. But the Seattle Chamber of Commerce commissioned a report or helped facilitate a report from McKinsey, one of the leading consulting firms, who took a look at the issue. And they said, sure, like, you could, there are plenty of changes you could make. But even if you did, you'd still need another $400 million a year to help fix your homelessness problem. And so you're going to have to find the money somewhere. And the problem is Seattle is limited in where it can go to raise money. It's already maxed out its sales tax and its property tax. And it's the other options are a business franchise tax and a utility tax. And so they had to be creative. That's the defense that we heard from the city council. And they figured that it's not going to have a big impact on how many employers come there. It's an attractive place to be, Seattle. And if it does constrain growth, this is what I heard from one of the main backers of the measure. Look, Seattle doesn't have a problem with growth. And they figure that they could take the edge off, and it might be a good thing.
Lydia, hang on with us. We're going to continue our conversation with Lydia DePillis this morning, senior economics reporter at CNN Money. We'll talk some more about Amazon HQ2.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
We're back with Lydia DePillis, senior economics reporter at CNN Money. We're talking about Amazon HQ2. Lydia, in your story, I'm back to the Dallas part of this. Dallas, you write, there have been 86,000 jobs added there in 2017 in the metro area, and adding 50,000 would push Amazon to be one of the biggest, if not one of the biggest, employers there. What's this had? What's the impact been there on housing, especially?
In Dallas?
In Dallas, yes.
Oh, I mean, it's not there yet, so it's hard to. Oh, the impact of job growth generally.
Yeah, with 86,000 already.
Sure, right. Well, yeah, Dallas has been a hot job market for several years now, not just because of energy, but also because of it, plenty of more, you know, the whole mortgage servicing industry is based there, for example. And so you think of Dallas-Fort Worth as an area with really generally affordable housing, but it has escalated. I don't have the numbers right off my head, but it's becoming less and less affordable. And so builders are struggling to keep up, but construction isn't infinite, right? We have constraints on labor and materials these days. So that's pushed housing prices up, and the concern was that bringing in Amazon could create even more of a problem. And that isn't to say that there's nothing cities could do to cushion the impact of a big employer like Amazon coming in, especially not just a big employer, but an employer with a median wage of around $100,000, which means that those folks have lots of purchasing power and could compete for the kinds of housing that that especially people in that market haven't been used to seeing. Seattle's very, very different still from Dallas in terms of housing prices. So that was a concern from some city council members. Now, that doesn't reflect everybody. I think their mayor is very pro Amazon, and it's hard not for politicians to not be excited about this kind of idea. People do get excited about it, but the thing that the skeptics are asking for is just a plan and some kind of commitment from Amazon that when the impact starts to be felt, they will participate in finding solutions for people who, you know, out of no choice of their own, ended up in the same city as Amazon's second headquarters.
A lot of the cities, I guess I think all of the finalist cities have been told to keep all of their plans under wrap and not talk to the media specifically and unveil their plans. Do you think that lack of transparency should be concerning to all of us?
Well, so one point of correction on that, I wrote about this when the bids were initially started to come in. Amazon isn't telling any city that you can't tell your constituents about what you're offering. They've made that very clear. The cities themselves are the ones that are keeping things under wraps. And they say it's because this is a competitive situation. Look, if you're a gambler, you don't put all your cards on the table. That's pretty much how economic development incentive bargaining works. But, you know, I think that transparency, that lack of transparency is a problem. And especially when you're going so all out with some of these packages, that'll have an impact on what types of taxes other people pay and the kinds of impacts on their commutes and their schools. And so a few things have come out. Maryland, for example, has not been shy about the fact that it is putting $5 billion in various types of relief and incentives on the table, and because ultimately most of these packages will have to come before legislative bodies to be approved. But once Amazon announces which city it has chosen, presumably that's how it will work. We're not sure exactly how they will communicate that, but once they make that announcement, I feel like it's going to be pretty much a done deal. It's not like a city is going to then renege and then for them to go on to their second choice. So, people are asking for transparency, and I can see why.
Well, the bottom line here is, and I think this is one of the headlines from CNN Money about this in another story, you know, whoever wins the second headquarters, that city will change forever. Those are high stakes.
They are, and it'll change in lots of ways, right? Like, there are plenty of cities for whom adding an employer like Amazon will be a game changer because of what it does to a nascent tech community. Like, I was in Houston for a year and a half. They're blessed with an enormous energy industry, but they are desperate to start something in the tech space to diversify and try to prepare themselves for any future downturn in the energy industry. And they're having a hard time because who wants to go to Houston when all your talent is being sucked up by the Exxons and Chevrons of the world? And that's not really a culture that supports startups. Now, Amazon is a lot of jobs, and that's really important, but there's also the impact it could have on accreting other small businesses that are spun out from Amazon or attracted by them and Amazon as a customer. So it'll change your economy, and it'll also change the landscape of your city and the prices in it. So it's a lot for cities to weigh.
Lydia, thank you for being with us this morning. Great conversation.
No problem. Thank you.
Lydia DePillis, senior economics reporter at CNN Money.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. Your Uber ride is getting even cheaper in Chicago. Uber announced that it's launching Express Pool, a service that directs multiple riders who are going in the same direction to specific pickup locations, allowing drivers to pick up riders in a straight line rather than navigating through side streets to pick up multiple people. The service costs less than Uber Pool, the company's other carpool feature. Chicago startup Provi, an e-commerce marketplace that's helping bars and restaurants order alcohol more efficiently, has raised $3.5 million in a seed round. Provi allows restaurants, bars, hotels, and other places that serve alcohol to order what they need on one platform instead of having to correspond with dozens of distributors individually. And TechNet, a bipartisan network of innovation economy execs, is opening a new office in Chicago, and it will be led by Jane McCaney, a former employee in Governor Rauner's office. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at chicagoinno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Friday edition of The Opening Bell. You and me and everybody else, when we get on a plane, somehow we tend to really go hard on the seats. That's among the topics we're going to discuss this morning with Brian Summers. He's the airline business reporter at skiff.com, and he is with us via Skype. Brian, before we move on to seats, let's talk about Southwest Airlines. I know we've been covering this from week to week after that window problem. There is an update on this story. What is it?
Southwest has been in the news a lot recently because of the tragedy that it had last month when an engine blade failed on a flight, and one passenger, unfortunately, was killed. That's been in the news a lot. One of the things that all airlines have been doing, not just Southwest, is inspecting these 737 engines from the manufacturer CFM, just to see if this might happen again. So Southwest said on Wednesday that it had completed engine inspections on more than 700 planes. That's all of them. They really didn't find anything that really concerned them, but they did say that they sent a small number of engine fan blades back to the manufacturer just to test them. People probably noticed that Southwest canceled some flights here and there just because they had to look at these engines. But all in all, things look pretty good. You know, you never say never, but let's hope that this doesn't happen again. We're going to have to wait a while until we find out the NTSB's final determination. So Southwest also said this week that bookings are actually still a little bit down. It's possible that some passengers are a bit skittish about booking Southwest. As we've talked about before, that probably shouldn't be the case, but there is a lag sometimes. Now, I hate to call this good news, but it is what it is. Southwest announced a big sale this week, and it's actually going to run through today, Friday. And we're seeing some fares as low as $49 from Chicago. Not to the most exciting places, Detroit and Cincinnati, I saw. But you can go to Las Vegas for $149 one way. And, you know, maybe they would have had this sale anyways, but it's probably to goose the numbers a little bit.
Brian, give us a sense of what goes into one of these inspections. It's a little bit more involved than just eyeballing it, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, they're called ultrasonic inspections. You know, one of the problems in the past, before this became a big deal, is some inspections were eyeballs, and you really can't tell flaws in the fan blades from just your eyes. So you've got to take the aircraft out of service, which generally airlines hate to do. But in this case, it's necessary. You've got to use special machines, and you really have to take it very seriously because, again, you're not going to find these cracks just by looking at them.
In the weekly Skift Airline Innovation Report, I love this, by the way, you write about how we abuse these seats on planes. I didn't realize that they got so much wear and tear. They obviously look like they do, but you found some really weird stuff.
Yeah, these are more fun stories to write, Steve. I did write a story this week about how passengers are just absolutely brutal to airline seats. They kick them, they scratch them, they write on them, they stand on them. Some manufacturer told me that, you know, they basically look worn after the first day. You know, you deliver a perfect seat and they're a mess after three or four flights on day one. And, you know, airlines would love to say, hey, you know, treat these seats as kindly as you do your car seats. But nobody does that. And so basically I spoke to the manufacturers and they say, you know what, we have to create basically a indestructible seat. And one of the ways that they do that is just by testing it. So one of the manufacturers said, look, we have this machine that simulates the absolute worst things that a passenger could do to our seat. Sometimes hundreds of thousands or even a million times. So one thing that they might do is just really harshly open and close the tray table just repeatedly, you know, because passengers, nobody really knows why they do this. It could be because passengers are bored. It could be because everything is unfamiliar to them, and so it's just not intuitive, and they're just tougher on the seats. It could be because they're angry at the airline. But whatever the reason, the seats have to be as reliable as possible. I wouldn't recommend this to people, but a manufacturer of business class seats, and of course those are more expensive to an airline, said, you know what? People could probably stand on our tray table and it would hold up. And the reason for that is not because they're built that way, but they are built so that people can lean on them to stand up. You know, a lot of people on a long flight have some trouble standing, and they just lean on that tray table and they put a ton of weight on it. Another manufacturer told me that the armrests are constructed so that you can stand on them. You're not supposed to stand on them. You shouldn't stand on them, but people do to get to the bins. And they're also constructed so that they can absorb a blow from a big bag that falls onto the armrest because people didn't quite get it, and it just falls. It's really amazing stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like the holy grail of airlines might actually be a passenger-proof seat.
Yes, I would say that. One of the manufacturers told me that a few years ago, they noticed that people were stealing seatbelts. So, first of all, they didn't know why, but if you Google this on the internet, you will see that some folks out there are making belts for pants out of seatbelts. So the buckle is the buckle from the seat, and the manufacturer had to put a special lock on the seatbelt so people wouldn't take it with them. It's incredible stuff.
Crazy. This is a story that I think a lot of people will be happy to hear, that it's getting easier to redeem frequent flyer miles.
Yeah, there's an annual survey that comes out every year. There's a analyst named Jay Sorensen who does this. And, you know, he sets out every year with this question, how easy or difficult is it to use frequent flyer miles? And he found this year it's getting a little bit easy. I think as a lot of folks won't be surprised to hear, Southwest makes it easiest to redeem frequent flyer miles. They actually allow people to redeem for reasonable rates on 100% of their flights. That's kind of amazing. And a mover in the survey this year was American Airlines, that's making a lot more free seats available than in recent years. So that's a good thing. The bad thing is, look, I mean, it's easier than ever to redeem these miles via credit card spending. So people that spend a lot of money on a Visa or a MasterCard do pretty well. As a lot of folks know, it's harder now to redeem the miles by flying. Most airlines are giving fewer miles than ever before, especially to people who buy cheap tickets. So yeah, it's easier to redeem miles, but if you're counting on earning miles just by flying, it's going to take you a little longer to get enough miles to redeem them.
And finally, let's talk about emotional support animals. American Airlines has finally updated its policy, or has put out a policy. What have they said?
Yeah, American Airlines had some fun with this. They're not the only airline to come out say recently, we're not going to fly a lot of emotional support animals. But they listed the ones that they wouldn't be flying anymore. And they included amphibians and ferrets and goats and hedgehogs and insects and spiders and snakes and rodents and something called sugar gliders. It's really quite amazing, the idea that people were ever bringing this stuff on as emotional support animals, especially like insects. But look, you know, American Airlines is still going to carry most dogs, and, you know, insects may be weird to travel with, but they're probably not going to harm anyone. And a lot of the things that have been in the news recently is like a dog that isn't technically an emotional support dog, but people say is one, will like bite somebody or, you know, go to the bathroom on the plane. And so this problem of poorly trained service animals is not going to go away. But American is doing its part to say, let's try to be a little bit more civil, and let's try not to abuse these policies anymore.
Yeah, the animals with tusks, horns, hooves are also grounded. And Brian, I had to look up sugar gliders. I had to Google it. It looks like a little baby opossum or something.
Yeah, it's funny. I wasn't familiar with it either, but a couple of months ago, I went down to Dallas-Fort Worth, where American is based, and they were very familiar with the sugar glider. So maybe they're more common down there. I don't know.
All right. Brian, thanks. Great conversation as always.
Thank you, Steve.
Ryan Summers is airline business reporter for Skift. That's at Skift on Twitter at skift.com. Make sure you sign up for the weekly Skift Airline Innovation Report delivered via email at skift.com/airline. And follow Brian on Twitter as well at Brian Summers.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures are up 79 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are also higher as we head to the opening bell a little bit later on this morning. Let's get an update now on agriculture and commodities. Good morning and happy Friday to Orion Samuelson.
And a happy Friday to you. First of all, Deere and Company issued its second quarter results this morning, and the manufacturer of construction equipment and farm equipment reported net income of $1.2 billion and Deere and Company's second quarter sales at $10.72 billion. Dollars, and that's above what the trade was expecting. So Deere & Company sees fiscal year 2018 sales up about 26%. A little bit of a surprise because the farm economy isn't improving that much. As we take a look at where we traded yesterday, Steve, live cattle futures finally bounced back. Technical buying and short covering following 3 days of steep declines, and June live cattle ended up $1.22 a hundredweight. And hogs did a little bit better yesterday on some firm cash markets and good pork demand. And then the grain market. Well, that keeps getting involved in what's going on between China and the United States, but wheat was up for the third day in a row. Corn and soybeans were weak. And I'm fascinated by the daily headlines that we get on the NAFTA situation because every day it's different. And the most recent one that came out yesterday talked about the fact that I think it was Canada that says there's a chance that we can get them done by the deadline. And then there's Mexico that says, well, it's going to be difficult. And then there's the United States that says, if we don't have a tentative agreement today so we can submit it to Congress so that they can pass it before the deadline, there won't be an agreement. So, Steve, as I've said many, many times, watching trade negotiations like watching paint dry. So,
yeah, I would not wager a bet on any of that, Orion. The other story I know the farmers are watching closely is the farm bill. What's the progress on that?
Well, again, there's criticism of the farm bill coming from some different sectors that are not directly involved in agriculture other than being consumers. There is, when the Constitution was written for the United States, there is a phrase in the Constitution that says states cannot set up individual demands on how the products that they're going to take from other states can be grown, and that has always been in the Constitution. But now there's a phrase in the Farm Bill that says you must not do anything in your state that would keep other states from being able to trade and sell. And of course, the caged egg production in California. California is trying to put into effect their own state law that says you cannot sell eggs in California if they haven't been cage grown. So they're trying to get away from this state by state set of rules that seem to pop up. I'm optimistic that we will get an agreement by the end of September, But with the food nutrition program being a part of the farm bill, that brings a lot of non-farm legislators into the picture, which is okay because it does give agriculture at least a little leverage. But it's not over yet, but it is making pretty good progress.
All right. Orrin, I understand we will see you later this morning here at the Big Ranch.
I wouldn't miss the big Walk of Fame celebration to salute Mary and Nick and, well, all the other great people.
We're looking forward to seeing you later this morning. Orrin Samuelson with us this morning, and make sure you listen to the morning show with Orrin and Max Armstrong, 5 to 6 o'clock tomorrow, right here on 720 WGN. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Friday, May 18th. Not a lot on the calendar today. A couple of Fed speakers are out there. Loretta Mester, Robert Kaplan, Lael Brainard. Not much in the way of earnings either. You heard Orrin mention Deere & Company is on the list today, as well as Apollo Investment, Campbell Soup Company, Luxoff Holding, Fisher & Paykel. And QAD Incorporated, all among those issuing quarterly earnings today. Just a few things that could move the markets.